The Playlist with Ben and Fiona.
There were some fascinating and disturbing experiments that were done around the 50s and 60s.
Welcome to The Playlist, where we talk about movies and TV shows that are worth your time. I'm Fiona Williams, and I manage our online coverage of movies and TV shows at SBS, and I'm joined by my co-host, SBS Channel Manager, Ben Nguyen. Hey, Ben.
Hi, Fiona. I happen to know, Fiona, that you had an award-winning weekend.
Oh, do you know? Oh, thank you, Ben. Thanks for bringing that up. Yes, little Eyes on Gilead.
In the podcast space.
Well, thank you. Yes. I mean, it could have been anything. Who knows? But no, it couldn't. What else do I do? Who am I? And also producer Jeremy and the team from Eyes on Gilead landed a bronze award at the Australian Podcast Awards on the weekend. So
yeah, congratulations. Congratulations to you and Jeremy and the rest of the presenting team. If only we knew when the next season of Handmaids was due so that we could all get ready for another round of Eyes on Gilead.
It's true, but yes, no idea. So we'll live on past glories for a while yet.
All we know is that 2021 will be a bigger, better year because it'll have more of your podcasting in it.
Oh, you? But enough about me. How are you? You've got some news.
I do have some news, but I will first let our listeners know that this week on The Playlist, for your speaking to Brandon Cronenberg, the writer-director of new sci-fi horror flick Possessor, and I'm taking a look at the new season of The Crown as Prince Charles finds his princess and lives happily ever after, maybe.
Have you watched it?
And in a very special wedding edition of What Have You Been Watching, Fee and I will compare notes on our favourite wedding scenes in movies.
Spoiler alert, Ben's getting married.
That might be the pretext for that discussion, but it is very exciting and, of course, movies are very much going to be an inspiration.
Ooh.
I say that now. Now I don't know if I can live up to it, but anyway.
Now you've got to change everything to planning.
Yeah.
Sorry, Sophie. Well, we've got a lot to get through, so where do we start?
Sophie, amongst your other award-winning activities, you've also caught the new horror sci-fi flick Possessor from the writer-director Brandon Cronenberg, a man with a familiar surname.
Yes, he does. Yes, son of David, for those who are wondering. I bet he loves being introduced like that all the time. But, yes, just one would think. So Brandon Cronenberg made Antiviral a few years ago now. I think it's going back about 8 years. So he's got his follow-up film out in cinemas now called Possessor. So he works in, you know, the sci-fi space and the horror. Probably it's an inherited trait. Who knows? And this one, it's a high-concept sci-fi where there's brain implant technology and basically a hired assassin takes over the body of a victim and that person then does the assassinating. You with me?
I'm intrigued.
Yes. And so, and you buy it. Like it doesn't focus on the technology of how that's all done. It just does. And there's a weird kind of looks like a VR rig that goes over the head. And what do you know? This assassin Voz, played by Andrew Riseborough, she's in the body of Christopher Abbott and he, as her, stay with me, then has to undertake this weird graphic assassination.
Our next contract's a big one. The target is the CEO of the largest operation in the U.S. He'll be binding to Colin Tate.
We can't afford any mistakes on this one.
Ready?
So it's all about living in someone else's skin and we see glimpses of her home life when she's not in other people's bodies and she's far more comfortable with her job than she is being herself. And there's a great support role by Jennifer Jason Leigh, who's sort of the CEO of this weird company. And so she oversees the whole operation and, you know, sees Andrea Riseborough go in and also brings her out and uses a few totems of her life to try and recalibrate her to make sure that she's herself and she's not got elements of this other person she just was. Well said. Well, I'm sure that makes a whole lot of sense.
Well, it sounds very of the time because I feel like the plot of 2020 would be incredibly hard to explain, but, you know, could be simply characterized as a sci-fi horror flick. So, you know, it's hitting the current mood.
Yeah, pretty much. And we're all just surrounded by totems that make us recalibrate to make sure who we are and what day it is and which Zoom call am I on today.
Yeah, no, it sounds cool. So I can't wait to hear what Brandon had to say.
Yes. So he joined me on a Zoom and I have to say there's one goal when you're a journalist doing interviews for someone who's been doing press for their film that's been out for a whole year. You want to ask that one question no one else has ever asked. And I got one in. So that was it.
She shoots, she scores.
I know, right? Every other one he's probably been asked a million times. But, you know, I got that one. So that was great. So here's Brandon Cronenberg. Hey, Brandon. Thank you so much for your time. It's really great to talk to you. I saw the film at Monster Fest a couple of weeks ago. So was able to see it at a cinema, which is great. This year, you're never quite sure.
Yeah, it's a rare treat.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's the best way to see it too. Look, one to start with. I mean, your film is about, you know, a corporate assassin who seems much more at home in other people's bodies than in her own skin. Opportunities for metaphors are rife. I don't know where to start with all the metaphors in that, but let's start with you. The germ of the idea, where did this all start from for you?
Well, it came from a kind of trivial personal place in a way. I was doing the press tour for my first feature, Antiviral. And it's a strange thing when you're traveling with a film for the first time because you're sort of consciously or unconsciously building this public persona. You know, you go around performing this version of yourself. It's like a media self or some double that then goes off and has a weird existence without you online. And so because of that and a few other things, I was finding I was waking up in the morning and feeling like I was sitting up into someone else's life and having to scramble to construct a character who could operate in that context. So I wanted initially to write a film about someone who may or may not be an imposter in their own life as a way to talk about how we build characters and narratives to function as people. And then the sci-fi thriller elements came out of that as I was developing it.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, you know, this interaction between us, it's not a natural chat, is it? It's, you know, I tend not to draft questions for my everyday interactions, but, yeah, we're kind of putting on a sometimes I wish I had, but, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a good way to operate. It's just who has the time.
Yeah, right. So, you know, bringing in the sci-fi elements, you know, having this corporate assassination world, you know, is it so far-fetched as well? Sort of, how did you research that? And yeah, you know, we've heard of MKUltra and things, but how can we, yeah, talk about the idea of bringing in that kind of corporate assassination world?
Sure. Well, I spent a fair bit of time researching the neuroscience behind it, not because the intention was to make realistic technology, just out of curiosity. And so, what I would say is that the technology, to a certain degree, is feasible. There were some really fascinating and disturbing experiments that were done, especially around the 50s and 60s, with brain implants. And I read a book written by this doctor, Jose Delgado, who was a Spanish doctor who worked in the United States implanting animals and eventually human patients with electrical stimulators. He called them stimoceivers that were basically receivers with wires on the end so he could remotely stimulate certain parts of the brain and that would allow him to control a kind of alarming range of motor function and emotional function and behavioral function. And in fact, there's a scene in the film where there's a bull on television that's this documentary footage. And that's actually one of the experiments he did. He implanted this bull with a stimoceiver and got into a bull ring with it. And it charged him and he was able to cause it to veer off before it gored him. So the science is there. But what I would say is that for the technology in the film to be realized in reality would probably take many, many years. And I didn't really want to make a far future predictive sci-fi film. The technology in the film is intended to be metaphorical and to be used as a way to discuss identity and the way we operate. So the film's actually set in a kind of alternate timeline. Not that it matters, but it's set in 2008 in Toronto in an alternate timeline where this technology is developed. And that was just for me to compartmentalize it so that I could be free to use those things however I wanted in this kind of alternate universe way.
Mm, yeah, the detail is there, but yeah, it's far more about the impact on the individual, isn't it? Yeah, that's far more interesting. That's where the drama lies. And, you know, maybe it's because of this year and the election and the pandemic and QAnon, just thinking of the idea of people being susceptible to to control or just these ideas. I think it's Tate in the film that mentions that Parasite could be an idea that takes hold in the body. Yeah, can we elaborate a little on that point? Am I drawing too far?
No. I mean, unfortunately, those aspects of the film have become more relevant since I started writing it. I started writing it in 2012, and so some of my initial interests were, first of all, just behavior, the way our brains work. And to me, I don't think that we have this kind of coherent identity. I think that's something we sort of apply after the fact to who we are. But every person is really a kind of chorus of conflicted impulses and ideas, some of them which originate from inside us and some of them which don't. And so that was initially where I started. Then the Snowden leaks happened and I started to add some of the political surveillance elements. And I think even from the time that we shot it to the time that it was released, the other aspects of it, the kind of social mind control aspects of it as a metaphor have become much more relevant. I was interested in that stuff to a certain degree, but now it really reads like a reaction to, for instance, Russian interference in the US elections and all of these aspects of mass manipulation through media that would have seemed like crazy conspiracy theories even a few years ago, but now which are just the basic realities that that we're dealing with. So that stuff is there. It's become more forefronted, I think, through no intention of my own, but it's to a degree on my mind when I started, and now it feels like sort of the central aspect of the film in some way.
Yeah. So, with the central character of Voss, you know, a white woman who we see her go into, you know, the body of a black woman, then of a white man. Curious in how you chose the bodies she'd go into and sort of the drama inherent in those moments. Yeah, how did you choose who she'd become?
In the case of Colin, when I actually initially was outlining the film, Voss was a man because I was responding to my own experiences and I just in a lazy way defaulted to a male character. But then I thought, first of all, it's sort of boring to me. I just wrote a male character. And secondly, it's a little bit cliche because we've all seen those films where the kind of father and husband is detached from his family because of the horrors of his work. You know, we've seen The Hurt Locker, we've seen those things. And then, of course, the obvious thing is that it's more interesting if she's spending time in a male body because you can play with those aspects of her character coming through in a kind of feminine way, and it gives the actor more to play with to sort of demonstrate her character through gender as well as through dialogue.
Yeah, for sure. And working with Andrea and Christopher, you know, essentially playing two sides of the same coin in the most intriguing moments of the film. Yeah, how did you work with them on that? And, I mean, they're actors. Obviously, they play other people all the time. But, yeah, your process with them.
It was interesting because I initially was on the verge of going down a bit of a rabbit hole with them where I was trying to figure out a formal system for allowing them to both play the same role. And I was wondering whether one of them wanted to take the lead and the other one wanted to imitate them, or did they want to be on set for each other's scenes, and how could that work? In practice, it was actually a very organic, collaborative process because they're both incredible actors and they're great to work with, and they brought so much to the characters. So I had my own specific ideas for how the two performances could overlap. They had ideas that they brought to me. This was all before we started shooting. During the shoot, I understand that they were in touch with each other between scenes to discuss how Voss would behave under certain circumstances and check in to make sure that they were in sync that way. And then in a scene-by-scene way, I worked with them individually. So it was all built out collaboratively in a surprisingly easy way.
Yeah, great. And with Jennifer Jason Leigh, how did she come about? And I guess leads to another question, like it invites comparisons with your dad's work with Existence. I don't know if that annoys you that happens, but was that a bit of a nod to that? How did she come about into the film?
It wasn't intended as a nod. It's just that my father's had a long career and he's worked with a lot of really great actors, so it becomes hard sometimes to completely avoid people who he's worked with. In the case of Jennifer, I think she's a brilliant actor in general, and also with that role in particular, there was a danger that it could be boring with the wrong actor, because performed the wrong way, Gerder becomes this sort of exposition character and a kind of non-character. But with someone like Jennifer, nothing she does is boring, and she's always going to find an interesting way to get into the character. And she brought a lot to it. All the elements with the cream and the mixing the vitamins into the water, those were things that she wanted to be able to play with the character. And so she really charged it with this this kind of energy.
Yeah, no, she's so great. And I love the scenes of bringing Voss back out and just the ideas of these artifacts that will trigger something. And, you know, that also seems a little bit performative as well. That idea of how to bring someone out of, being in the machine. Sorry, not saying this well at all, but the idea of using artifacts in that way. Can you expand a little on the thinking there and why you chose the particular piece that you have?
No one has ever asked me that question. those were pieces from my life, actually, not specifically those, but they were similar to things that I have just from my past. And I like the idea of someone trying to recover their identity through these sort of physical nodes or these things that they've build their identity around and these memories, of course, that were associated with them.
Okay. Well, I'm pleased to hear no one's asked you that one before. That's the one that no one would have asked.
Yeah, and I've had a lot of interviews right now, so it's rare to get a completely new question.
Well, happy to help in any way I can. let's see if I can do another one. I'm not going to, I'm sure. I guess expanding on that idea of the world we're living in now and how to deal with bringing people out of this kind of cult mentality that some people have. I don't expect you to solve everything, but just do you think that can help to wake people up a little bit from the moment we're living in? I don't know. That's a big philosophical question that I'm putting to you.
Can art do it? Are you asking, like,
yeah,
art in general?
And just reconnecting with things that we identify with.
I don't know. Probably not. Because I think what is so dangerous and what we need to deal with in the next couple of decades of human existence is that these forms of manipulation are completely invisible to us. So everybody who's going around having an opinion that was crafted for them by a foreign state is doing that not knowing that they've been manipulated, and they will completely dig their heels in when confronted with that information and insist that no, it's them. And if anything, I think cling to that position even more strongly. So to a certain extent, I think we can shed light on these things by discussing them and by drawing attention to attempts to manipulate, but also it's so inherent to just how the technology works. I mean, you know, Google's entire model is data mining, and more we will become very predictable and malleable and in a sense hackable by people who have access to this constant information stream that we're exposed to. That sounds in some ways very old. I sometimes feel like an old man raging against social media, but it isn't that. It's just the reality. I mean, so much of who we are is sculpted by this information that we're exposed to constantly, and people have access to the details of our psychological landscapes through the information that we put back out there. And that's something that I think we're only just starting to recognize as being a serious problem, and what that means for human society in the next couple of decades is hard to completely see right now. I think we're in a transitional era.
Yeah, no, so true. And we'll still keep giving each other listening devices for Christmas. And I guess
for sure, I have so many listening devices. I mean, the flip side of it is the technology is absolutely great and wonderful. I'm not a technophobe at all. I love that stuff, but it's also completely changing what we are. And in some dangerous ways.
Yeah, no, so true. And your film, was it Sundance, just as COVID was hitting elsewhere, and now it's coming out during. How have you been using the time during the pandemic? How have you been, have you used it creatively? Like, are you sort of madly writing films and writing scripts? What have you been up to?
I've been doing my best. There was a very long development period between my two features that I hope to not repeat. So I've been trying as much as possible to set myself up to be able to shoot as soon as I'm able to. And I know some people who are shooting. I mean, film production really shut down at the beginning of the pandemic, but it's now starting to open up in various ways as people figure out protocols that seem to be working and keeping sets COVID-free. So I'm hoping that I'll be able to shoot something soon. And if not, I guess the vaccines help us.
Exactly, right. Do you think we'll have a rise of pandemic movies? And will anyone want to watch them after having lived through it? I hope you haven't written a pandemic movie.
No. I haven't. I'm interested. I mean, there already are pandemic movies coming out. I think there's a Michael Bay produced a pandemic movie that's coming out. And I have a friend who shot a movie during lockdown with somebody. I don't know if people want to see that or what the approach is. I think part of the difficulty is that certainly with horror and science fiction, when there is a virus movie, the virus stands in for other things. It's metaphorical. And so how do you make it worth shooting a virus movie right now, because the virus can't stand in for anything else? We take it so literally. It's like trying to shoot a film about eating breakfast and where breakfast is a metaphor for something else. You know, it becomes very, very difficult to make that worthwhile. So it'll be interesting. I don't know. I think certainly we're all having this sort of bizarre relationship with the same virus, and to a degree, art can and should deal with that. But it's hard to say. I don't think it's enough to just sort of make a movie where there's an outbreak, because we're living that.
Yeah, it's been done, and in the real world too. And have you been binging a lot? Have you been watching lots of things?
I owe a lot of writing these days, so I haven't been watching as much as I should be.
That's fine. Everyone else is making up for it, I think. So, yeah. Well, look, thank you so much. I know you're a man in demand this morning for interviews, but no, it's been lovely to talk to you. And yeah, I really love the film too, if I didn't mention that before. Lots of good stuff in there.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for talking to me as well.
Ta.
So that was Brendan Cronenberg, the writer-director of new sci-fi horror flick Possessor. And where can we see that, V?
That is in limited release in cinemas. So, yeah, that's fun. Go and do that if you can. And I think we all can around Australia now. So, yeah, get out there.
Yeah, exciting. And good to hear he's been using his pandemic time wisely and being productive.
I know, extremely productive, writing scripts and reading books and not just staring at his phone doom-scrolling like I have. But anyway, yes.
Yeah, well, I've just been watching television. In fact, the new season of epic royalty drama The Crown out on Netflix.
Your Majesty, I think we have enough respect for one another personally to ask ourselves some of the bigger questions. Woman to woman. We are the same age after all.
Really?
Just 6 months between us.
Oh? And who is the senior?
I am. Ma'am.
And so this is season 4. Now, have you heard of the royal family, Fee?
In passing, yeah. I know of them. I know there's been a few documentaries about them around, some of them on SBS, but yeah. I know of them. I'm not a hardcore viewer of The Crown, it must be said. I watched the first season and enjoyed it, but yeah, I've not kept up to date. But maybe this season will bring me back in. You've watched all seasons?
Yeah, yeah. I think Olivia Colman took over the role of Elizabeth in the last season, and in fact, this is her last season in that role, and then the baton will be handed on next. But I think that what the show does do well is the story of the royal family is very much a soap opera, and that's the way that we often get told it through the gossip magazines and in the UK, the tabloid newspapers. But I think what The Crown does well is it pulls you in with the soap opera, but then what it actually allows the show to do is give you a history lesson of the period in which it's set. And this most recent season is bookended by the election and then the sort of abrupt departure from office of Margaret Thatcher. So this is the Thatcher's Britain season of The Crown.
With Gillian Anderson in that starring role.
Yes, Gillian Anderson, the partner of the show's writer, Peter Morgan. And she really does do an incredible job channeling Margaret Thatcher. I think, you know, we've seen occasional depictions on screen. We've, of course, had Meryl Streep playing the Iron Lady at one point. And I think sort of it's very interesting for where you personally sit politically, because it's quite a sympathetic portrayal of Margaret Thatcher. But over time, some of her, the sort of strictness of her political ideology comes through, and you begin to see, I guess, sort of the way in which she, in this portrayal anyway, paints herself as a woman who came from a very middle-class background, the daughter of a shopkeeper, didn't have the privilege of birth that Queen Elizabeth, of course, did. And you know, the two were pitted against each other on occasion in the regular meetings that the Prime Minister has with the monarch. Mm-hmm. And really, she does feel this mission to transform Britain into a place where you either work hard and succeed or you fail. And that, of course, was the rather brutal reality of Thatcher's Britain, is that many were left in a very challenging personal and financial positions. And that leads us to one episode, which was a standout episode, where a working class man who had lost his family in a kind of custody battle breaks into Buckingham Palace and has a 15-minute conversation with Queen Elizabeth, sharing his feelings about Thatcher's Britain. And what the show does in that episode is takes that away from being just a kind of shocking event and sort of turns that into sort of a real moment of understanding for Elizabeth and I suppose sort of brings out that connection that she feels for her subjects.
Yeah, right. Yeah, interesting, because it was always reported as a major breach of protocol and whatnot, that the real event. But yeah, okay, it's interesting that's in there.
And the other major storyline of this season, which is, I guess, kind of what a lot of fans, I would say, have been waiting for, is the Charles and Di story. And so we get Prince Charles, who has had this relationship with Camilla, deeply in love with her, but she's not seen as an appropriate match for him. And so, as we've seen through other characters' storylines in The Crown, once again, your heart and your sense of duty are pulling you in two different directions. And so Charles does meet this, you know, very young, 18-year-old sort of young woman, like very, very different in personality in her own life experience. And for mostly superficial reasons, the firm, you know, the family of the palace collectively make the decision that this is the right match for him and this will be the future Queen of England. But as we know, that didn't come to pass.
Correct. And I, just as an aside, I have heard friends who are talking about being midway through The Crown and whatnot and then just doing the whole, oh, no spoilers. It's sort of, I mean, guys, this is very recent history. So anyway, I have to laugh when people are worried about spoilers in The Crown. But
yeah. Yes,
it didn't all quite work out for Charles and Di.
Yeah. So we don't actually see the famous wedding between Charles and Di. And apparently the reason for that is because, you know, that exists on YouTube and captured by endless cameras. So we see other moments. We see the rehearsal ahead of the wedding, and we see Diana, who is almost kept as a prisoner within Buckingham Palace in the lead-up with no contact from Charles whatsoever, as she, out of boredom, pulls on her roller skates and Walkman and skates through the halls of power. So
as
just expressing her sort of, you know, teenage desires for sort of fun and all, you know, that whole world is about to be taken away from her. But I think sort of what I found really interesting is it's a much more sympathetic portrayal of Prince Charles's side of that relationship than what I'm used to. I mean, the actor of Charles is, I think, very, very good. And he, I mean, I don't think I've ever realized how slouchy and pouty and sulky Charles is, sort of according to this. But nonetheless, he does seem like, you know, a deeply wounded, deeply intelligent man that does have this genuine bond with the very high energy Camilla. Mm. And Diana has very little to offer him. And if anything, she comes across as a bit of a brat. And so there is, like, I think, a bit of an attempt to rewrite the public affection in these relationships.
That's intriguing. Yeah. And it's good to hear that it's not repeating the same scenes we've seen in the same outfits and the same moments and just analysing it if they get the eye lines right or whatever. The dress is in there, isn't it, with its miles sleeves. Yeah.
I mean, I think we see it from behind, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, it's good to hear there's nods to those moments that we all identify with. But, yeah, it sounds a bit more maybe true to the loveless match that we've all heard about in the documentaries.
Yeah, well, it underlines, I guess, the purpose of The Crown, which in dramatising the lives of these completely public figures, is trying to take us into those internal moments and that didn't play out in the tabloids and what are the stories between them. But I think, you know, we also sort of see the consequences of the terrorist actions by the IRA in this season. We see a lot of drama play out around the plan to place sanctions on South Africa because of apartheid. Richard Roxburgh, who neither of us are hugely fans of, but he gets to replay his role of Bob Hawke. And
he does a good Hawkey.
Yeah, yeah. And as Charles and Di do their tour of Australia and New Zealand, and Bob attempts to try and use that as a springboard for the Republican movement in Australia and what that does to threaten the Crown.
Spoiler, not much. Yeah, well, good. And I have seen some funny moments on Twitter and whatnot of where scenes are made to look like Brisbane in 1982 that are very much not Brisbane in 1982. It's always fun to see your own country depicted when clearly it was shot elsewhere.
Yeah, I think for a show that does have huge budgets and obviously has a lot of locations doubling as existing locations, including all the manor houses and castles, etc. And Australia does get that treatment with apparently they shot pretty much all those scenes in South Africa. So doing double duty as Australia. Even the sheep at the sheep station don't quite look like Australian sheep to my eyes, but, you know. That's nitpicking,
you've got a very
surely.
Particular, you've got a good eye for that kind of thing, Ben. Yeah. But, I mean, you know, who
we'll
knows
when. We'll do a sheep-themed episode sometime in the future, I'm sure.
Yeah, save it. Mm. Yes, but who knows in the world we're currently in. Things are going to have to double for other places a lot more. It happens all the time. But, yeah, we just get funny about it when it's Australia, don't we? but, no, intriguing. Okay. Well, that's The Crown season...
Four.
Okay, good thought. We'll have to get onto that on Netflix. So all this talk about unions of Charles and Di that, let's face it, wasn't a great match. That's a weird segue.
There's a few weddings, well, let's say marriage do's and don'ts in that pairing, I think.
Correct. Take notes. yes, we were thinking in honour of everyone but me apparently watching Crown Season 4, but mostly in honour of Ben's upcoming connubials, we'd talk about weddings and the way movies structure themselves around those events, or sometimes it just happens to be a wedding in a movie that's about something else and the memorable moments thereof in them. So we're going to do a bit of a shot for shot on great movie weddings.
I love a wedding in a movie. I sort of joked before that movie weddings had influenced my planning, but I mean, for example, I love those outdoor marquee weddings that happen in movies where, you know, they're out on the lawn and, you know, sort of maybe there's a band playing in the corner, and I haven't borrowed all those aspects, but there's a sort of some of those influences have definitely seeped into what I've wanted out of getting hitched.
Excellent. Look forward to it. What's one movie reference like that that's inspired you?
I don't know sort of whether this is positive inspiration or not, but I thought I would start with mentioning a movie that it's hard to talk about weddings and not mention this movie. It is The Wedding Singer.
Yeah.
Directed by Frank Coraci and starring Adam Sandler and Drew Barrymore. Set in the 1980s. And a real pleasure of this movie is just those horribly dated 1980s weddings. and it serves as a good reminder that you should not go too far out into the fashion of the day, or else you will be haunted by your photos and videos forevermore into the future.
Yeah, try not to be right on the cutting edge of fashion. Yeah, go for a classic look perhaps, and then you'll be happy with your photos. Talking of Di's wedding sleeves, good Lord.
It also has a very amusing scene with Steve Buscemi giving a drunk best man speech and having pretty much to be dragged off stage. And that's also a reminder not to have drunk people that hate you give speeches at your wedding.
Correct. I think it's something that for everyone, yes. Or at the wedding at all, yes.
What about you? What's a wedding movie or a scene that's spoken to you?
Yeah, well, I too thought of The Wedding Singer. That is a lot of fun. Look, and this is a weird one for what brought us into this conversation, but maybe not so much. I thought of Melancholia, sort of the Lars von Trier film that's kind of a lovely, lavish outdoor wedding that takes place on the eve of the apocalypse. But I thought you've sort of flipped that in that it's 2020, you're getting married at the end of the year. You know, you've taken everything in your stride for the wedding of the year, and it's the only wedding that I know of that's happened this year, so good on you for getting in there. Yeah, this very lavish film with Kirsten Dunst, yeah, and the wedding, the marriage is more, as with a lot of these films, it's, you know, the symbol of other things and, yeah, it's more a metaphor for things. But, yeah, end of the world is coming. Who knew? No one in that film. They just wait it out and things get weird.
Well, on the topic of high concept movies around weddings, recently I checked out Palm Springs, which is out now on Amazon in Australia, and it stars Andy Samberg and Kristen Milioti, and they play not the betrothed couple but two people who basically hook up at the wedding and then get led into a time warp, which is not much fun for anyone.
I have seen this film, yes. I like it very much. Like, it's a slow reveal of the concept, but it's in the synopsis, so I don't think it's a spoiler to say. But he is certainly living this Groundhog Day, so he's been to this wedding who knows how many times. He speaks like it's been happening for years, and he remembers every time, and he's very jaded. So he's stuck in an infinite loop, and then through circumstances, so is she. And, yeah, it's Groundhog Day. Of course it is, but it plays with the science of that in ways as well. And yeah, there's a bit more pain to it in some of the comedy as well. And I think Andy Samberg's really good in it. And I'm not always a huge fan of him, but sometimes they just cut the day short because it's like, no. And then the day restarts so you don't have to wait out the whole day. But no, I think it's really good. And again, it's a good one for 2020 because haven't we all just sort of been living the same day a little bit?
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, I think it actually does, there's something about it that captures being at a certain point in a relationship, at a certain point in your life, where you're maybe sort of attending a lot of weddings and, you know, not sure whether you're yourself ready to make that leap. And there's something, I think, that feels truthful around the ways that these two characters are figuring each other out in the fact that they're having to kind of go through this experience over and over and what that sort of starts to reveal about who they really are.
Yeah, agreed. I think, and that, like, that's where it plays in the rom-com kind of world, and that's where it's nod to Groundhog Day, which is why Groundhog Day you can watch over and over again. I think it's a really, really good addition to that concept, and it's completely relevant to our current discussion.
I'm going to jump to another high concept sort of time travel-y movie. The Deeply Romantic About Time from Richard Curtis. Which isn't in itself a wedding movie, but I think it is a really sort of sweet movie starring Domhnall Gleeson as a man who learns he has the ability to travel through time and the way that he does use that to shape his romantic life. But it does have a very disastrous wedding scene where the married pair emerge from the church and the weather turns in a very terrible way. And the whole wedding kind of gets rained out, which sort of living with doing some wedding planning right now is a very great fear of mine.
Check that long range forecast.
Speaking of Richard Curtis, I feel like you can't mention his name without going to one of the granddaddies of wedding films in recent memory, which is Four Weddings and a Funeral.
Well, mathematically, I mean, it needs a mention alone. Yes, of course. Yeah, that one I haven't watched in a few years, but yeah, you know, it holds up. It's spawned a whole range of not so great ones in its wake, and I mean, it certainly set Hugh Grant up for rom com work for many moons.
It did. I mean, I sort of just remember one of the things I sort of liked about it is, I mean, obviously we do see, as in the title expresses, we see four different weddings that are in different sort of styles and scales. But I think in some of those weddings there's just sort of a real naturalism. And I it reminds me of another wedding scene in a favourite movie of mine, The Commitments, where they discover the lead singer of the band when he jumps onto the mic at a wedding. And just sort of those cutaway shots of like little children in that case, little Irish children sliding on their, you know, in their socks kind of across the dance floor. That does feel to me true of weddings that I attended when I was a little kid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, doing the chicken dance and all that on the floor. I hope that wasn't just me. And not only when I was a kid. Yes. And, you know, it's fairly recent that we've had marriage equality across the world, really. And we haven't really seen a great spate of queer-themed wedding movies yet. I was sort of trying to rack my brain for one to include in here, but, because I thought also of The Wedding Banquet, but that's pre-marriage equality when it's very much about Ang Lee's Wedding Banquet, of course. About a Taiwanese property developer in New York who is a gay man and has to fake a wedding for his parents to get them off his back for marrying and, which is, you know, that whole farce kind of story that playing with cultural expectations and whatnot. Great movie.
I love that movie.
Yeah, it's so good. But yeah, I think we need to have a spate of queer themed wedding movies to add to the canon. So if I'm forgetting anything, please, you know, let me know on Twitter. But yeah, we haven't had too many yet.
Yeah, that's a good point. The Wedding Banquet does remind me, sadly not a queer wedding film, but a wedding film that did break some barriers, which was Crazy Rich Asians recently, which, you know, really put Asian actors as the romantic leads in a hugely successful way.
Yeah, in a big, lavishly, hugely successful way. Yeah, totally. And it was fun. Yeah, and we need a whole lot more of them, I think.
I'm going to turn now to a couple of favourites of mine, but this is sort of where the wedding really is. There's actually some heartbreak sitting behind it. So going to an Australian film first, again, I just feel like we can't have this conversation without talking about Muriel's Wedding.
It was going to be my number one.
Yep. Oh, cool.
It's fine. Yeah. No, no, go.
Well, I think that, you know, obviously Muriel is so invested in this wedding representing everything that she's ever sought for in life and the escape from the world that she grew up in. And it doesn't end up offering her all of that. And you know, that's the big, big lesson for her. I mean, it is a very beautiful wedding scene. But I think sort of what makes it sort of even more memorable is the fact that you really do know that she's going to be heartbroken ultimately.
Yeah, poor Muriel Heslop. All she wanted to do was get married and ends up in a marriage of convenience with an Olympian. Yeah, and it's
like
a one-way ticket to heartbreak. I mean, yeah, you know. Coulda, woulda, shoulda, but yeah, Muriel, she changes the name, Muriel Van Arkel. Yeah, it's a short-lived honeymoon, but she gets the photo spread in Woman's Day and she does look gorgeous on the day. But, yes, no, it's a takes a while to learn the lesson that it's not all about the dress, it's about the union. Yeah, no, this is one of my all-time favourite movies, let alone a wedding movie. And I interviewed PJ Hogan for Mental, which sort of riffed on the same theme because it was about his family. Yeah. But and I couldn't not share with him how much I was obsessed with Muriel's Wedding. And he challenged me on my fandom and I quoted the line about the, you know, the bitchy women who were cleaning up the house after Betty and she goes, you're right about those cupboards. Anyway, deep dive, and he said, geez, you are a fan. So, yes, I am very much. So I'm glad you mentioned it because I was going to as well. So, yeah, just the best. And fantastic performance by Toni Collette, just embracing.
Yeah, once again, just sort of a performance that kicked off a really extraordinary career.
Yeah.
Speaking of PJ Hogan, I feel like he also made another hugely successful wedding movie, and I can see you rolling your eyes a little bit, but that also had heartbreak at the heart of this wedding, which is My Best Friend's Wedding, where yes. Julia Roberts is so in love with her best friend and tries to sabotage the wedding and ultimately doesn't succeed and realizes that that's for the best.
Yes. I forget that PJ Hogan also made that, you know. it's the movie he got to make in Hollywood after having made Muriel's Wedding and Bia, Lavisha. You get Julia Roberts at the peak of her powers, Cameron Diaz and such. Yeah, look, it's big and fun. I've just seen it so many times, it's always on somewhere. yeah, but I can see why people love it.
And I do have one more, and I'm going to stick with the Australian theme and also the heartbreak at a wedding, which is, this is not really what I want out of life, but, you know.
It was a good idea at the time.
but maybe it's what I want out of a movie.
Well, if all wedding theme movies were happy and all about just the relationship working, they wouldn't be very exciting movies. So, yes, this is the opposite of what you want your wedding / marriage to be.
So this is one of my favourite movies and one of my favourite Australian movies, Thank God He Met Lizzie. Starring Richard Roxburgh, when I like to think he was a bit younger and less full of himself. Richard, if you're listening.
He said that. and a young Cate Blanchett.
Yes, a young, very beautiful Cate Blanchett. And we see their wedding play out across the course of the movie. And then meanwhile, what drives the narrative is his flashbacks to his previous relationship with a woman played by Frances O'Connor and his gradual realisation, I think, that she was the one that got away. Or maybe he knew it all the time, but I guess sort of everything about the way that relationship worked contrasts with the relationship that he's entering into now. And I think it's a really beautiful movie. I think it's a very funny movie. And I think it's a very heartbreaking movie.
Yeah, good call. It's underrated, I think. And a little scene. Yet that one's not on all the time, unlike My Best Friend's Wedding. No, good point. It's been a while. Have to look that one up.
Yeah, I'd advise that for everybody. Have you got any more weddings? Just to sort of give us a boost.
Give us a boost. Yeah, we've left one down there. What have we got? Well, I haven't actually got it on my list, but I thought of one before when you were talking about the marquees and whatnot. And given you're having a destination wedding, I thought of Destination Wedding, which I may have mentioned on the show previously as what I was watching. But anyway, Keanu and Winona together again as guests at a wedding who really they're not particularly close to the couple, so they more go for just the wine and a weekend away. And then, of course, they hate each other on site, and of course they're meant to be together, and of course they go and shag in the wilds of wine country and whatnot, and it's just a hoot, and they're having a great time, and it's a great time watching them. Is it a memorable movie? Not so much, except it is to me. Destination Wedding, I don't know where you can watch it. Saw the DVD and bought it, and maybe you should too.
Yeah, no, I haven't seen that.
Not many people have. I doubt even Keanu and Winona.
Yeah. I'll have to sort of rummage through my local DVD bargain bin.
I'll lend it to you when you get back from your
honeymoon. Yeah, that sounds like a good one.
Good times. So on that note, this brings us to the end of our wildly themed wedding episode, which is all to say we're going to be off for a couple of weeks because of Ben's upcoming nuptials. So wishing you and your beautiful bride all the very
Thank
best
you
for
very
your big
much.
Day. And we hope it's free of all the dramas that we talked about in the wedding movies we spoke about today. It's going to be great.
Oh, thanks, Fee. That really means a lot. It is our last show for a little bit, but please make sure that you subscribe to SBS The Playlist wherever you get your podcasts and give us a lot of stars and leave us a nice review because it helps people to find the show. And you can let us know what you thought of movies and TV shows we discussed and particularly any favourite wedding movies on Facebook or Twitter at SBS Movies, and I'm on Twitter at Ben Nguyen TV.
And I'm on Twitter at Anything But Fifi.
And the playlist is produced by the award-winning Jeremy Wilmot. Until next time.
Thanks for listening. And happy wedding, Ben.